You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do. So she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode is brought to you by our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Mythgreen's Podcast. I'm Oren. With me today is...
Wes.
And joining us is a recurring special guest, Sarah.
Hello.
Sarah, it's been a while, but welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Oren.
Yeah, glad you're here.
Sarah has a lot of experience with RPGs that are more weighted towards the story game side of the scale. So I thought that her voice would be very beneficial for this series of episodes we're going to be doing where we're talking about various role-playing game aspects. And today, we are talking about the lessons we learned from the first campaign that we ran. So who wants to go first? I can tell how we're all really excited about this.
I don't mind starting, I guess. I kind of had like a two-pronged start that was separated by many, many years. And when I was writing up some notes for this, I kind of wondered if like my memory of the first instance actually ever happened, because I was thinking I need to like look up what I actually played to like find proof of it online, and I couldn't.
Does this game even exist?
I don't know, but like listeners out there, I'm pretty positive it was some kind of Dungeons and Dragons starter kit. Things I remember: really elaborate pre-made characters with good art, Thaco, and a picture of a dragon that I was pretty sure was the devil because it terrified me.
Could have been.
Yeah. That's important because I don't know how this came into my possession, but I remember discovering it maybe at a friend's place and us playing it, and I ran the adventure when we took a youth group trip to a Christian music festival called Creation, which is at the Gorge by George in Washington State here.
And you played D&D at a Christian music festival?
So I wasn't cool enough to play it there. I was cool enough to play it on the bus there and on the bus back. I think I was fairly concerned for my soul the entire time and didn't want to critically fail at faith or something like that at the time. So
look, you can do that. There are RPGs where you can critically fail at faith now, because faith is a stat you can roll.
What?
So that's like a legitimate concern.
Okay, good. That makes me feel a little bit better.
I imagine this dragon is really like the actual devil, like that instead of breathing fire, it makes you like roll for saving throw for faith.
It felt like that. Maybe it just was, the whole thing was a test that I must have passed with flying colors, who knows. But yeah, like I'd read the adventure. It came with a pre-made adventure, and I had a general understanding of what was going on. I had no idea how Thaco worked, and I'm pretty sure I still don't have any idea how Thaco works.
Nobody knows.
Yeah,
how
right.
Thaco
we talk.
Works.
We tried to talk Thaco, about that.
Is it Thaco or Thaco? I mean,
it's Thac Zero.
it's actually hard to search for, even because that last O is actually a zero. So if you search for Thaco with an actual O, nothing will come up.
Oh my gosh. Well, that explains it.
I like Thwacko.
Yeah, and. So, I mean, I just had a bunch of, fellow heathens in the back of the bus, and, you know, we distributed character sheets and shared a story. And, you know, like, there was definitely some things that I just probably didn't do right. You know, like, I didn't know exactly how it worked. I don't remember being very fair with time. Like, people who could, you know, contribute to the story, who were the more gregarious types, they tended to dominate the entire thing. But I think on the whole, like, that was a positive experience for a few reasons. We were playing on a bus, so we didn't have a table, which meant that like the few dice that I have, we couldn't roll. and mm-hmm. I could discover that I could have a very enjoyable role-playing experience without rolling any dice.
That is really impressive that, yeah. Like, this was your first game and you were already jumping into like the diceless role-playing circle.
I think Oren, that like that was possible because I didn't really understand the rules, so I was like, dice, well, can't we just say what happens? I think we're gonna have,
yeah, I don't like dice means I could fail. I don't want to fail.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not cool.
And let's see, I think, oh yeah, the other thing that I really remember coming away from that is a really shy friend of mine, you know, always liked hanging around, but was never really kind of a fully incorporated part of the youth group. He really came into his own during that. He got to, he was the one who found the gauntlets of ogre strength. And I just remember like his finding the loot and like equipping the gear and then suddenly just deciding that he was the god of the game. It was just like an amazing transition to like see that happen, you know, for him to like really embody like the character in that way. So mm-hmm. yeah, letting characters do cool stuff and get cool loot, I think that was a good takeaway from that experience.
Look, there are a lot of GMs who I think could do to learn the lesson of let your players be cool, okay? Let their characters do cool things and get cool stuff. It's like, yes. You know, that's a decent bar of fun right there, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
That was everything in high school was like that. Like, I played with my brother and his friends, and we would have, like, Pikmin. We went to a special dimension filled with Pikmin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there were baby dragons. There was, like, basically anything that someone wanted, we would give each other gifts when we ran games for each other.
That's great.
That's my very first encounter. The second one happened, oh, my God, like, 6 years later. I don't know what happened to me in high school. That was...
So there's a bit of a gap. You had a bit of a gap there.
Yeah, I basically had... That was, like, very early high school, I think freshman year. And then the next time I did it was very consciously, and that was sophomore year of college, where there was this bookstore we liked to go to, and we saw the full set of the 3.5 D&D books. And so we all decided, it was me and a group of five friends, that we're like, this is what we're doing now. We're just going to do this. And so that was a lot more deliberate, a lot more involved, and basically have just been solidly playing since then. But, you know, what was kind of funny is, and maybe this was the nature of 3.5 or like my approach to it, is I think I developed some really bad behaviors from that I've just like been fixing over time. I mean, we know like how mechanical 3.5 was, like. Mm-hmm. Just like, I mean, everything, and that seeped into my brain. I feel like I just couldn't let anybody do anything without having them roll for it, you know, just even simple things like jump over this puddle, right? Oh, nope, you tripped, you're dead.
Like, well, there's a jump skill for that. I mean, they wouldn't put that in there if you weren't supposed to use it, right?
Yeah, it's there, you have to use it. But I mean, yeah, it was frustrating. And I think it just led to a lot more planning that was necessary. All the players had to plan it. And it was like, you have to have all these feats if you want to do anything cool. But you can't swim because you forgot to take that ability, right? Like, so yeah, it was just, I got bogged down in rolling and numbers because I felt like that was like the secret to like unlocking how fun the game could be, is if I kept like full details and notes of everything. And so I've been unlearning a lot of that behavior since then.
Y'all better be tracking how many arrows you have.
Oh dear.
Because you will run out. I will enforce that. Alright, Sarah, as the guest, you get to go next.
Yeah, Sarah, tell us.
Tell us about your first campaign.
Okay, my first campaign was in high school. So I made my own role-playing game from the first game that I ran.
Oh wow.
Cool.
Yeah. So I based it on Fudge, which is basically a starter, if you will, like a sourdough starter, but for a role-playing game system instead of mm-hmm. for bread. And I just had a bunch of my friends over in my basement, which, you know, I had already been playing in other people's Dungeons & Dragons games, but this was my game. And yeah, it was, my players were about as mad as you could expect. Like, they would just basically try everything they could. And because it's Fudge, it's not D&D, you can't say like, oh, did you take this skill? It was just entirely improv, yes and, all the time. And I was trying to be a good GM, so I would say yes to pretty much anything they could reasonably, you know, that they could convince me to do.
Oh, dear.
So there is this house, and there were some, they're supposed to go into the house, and in the attic, there's supposed to be some documents, some important documents that they could get that would lead them to the next part of the campaign. And there were a bunch of like orcs and stuff around that they would have to fight in order to get up into the attic. But
sounds good.
Yeah. So one of the players is like, you know what? I'm going to make a Molotov cocktail. And naive little me was like, wait, what's a Molotov cocktail? Ah, well, you see, it's you have this exploding bottle. I know how to make it. Like, the player knew how to make it. I'm like, well, I guess that sounds simple enough. Sure, you can make it. You know, how are you going to get it up there? Well, one of the other players had a ninja koala. Because, again, I said yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, of course. Yes. Why would you not have one of those?
You can't say no to that.
And, you know, this is, as you can probably tell, a kind of pseudo-fantasy setting. So, you know, ninja koala didn't actually make sense in the world. But, hey, I was going to make my friends happy. So they gave the Molotov cocktail to the ninja koala, threw the ninja koala up into the upper story window. The ninja koala dropped the Molotov cocktail and then, like, I guess, ninja'd down and away. The
koala was fine, though, right? Like, that's yes. I'm really concerned about that.
The koala was fine. They came up with some way in which the koala would not explode with the whole rest of the building. Yeah, so there went all of my finely laid plans. Like,
oh no.
Like, at least one encounter down the drain. And
it's like, I would like to roll to skip the encounter, please.
And I said yes. But they had such a good time doing it, and what I ended up doing was have one of the orcs escape, and mm-hmm. when they were going off to do whatever they were going to do, like in the woods, they come across this orc, and he has the papers on him miraculously. And yeah, it was just a whole bunch of quick thinking to try to get them this vital information and get them on their way as quickly as possible.
I just realized, because like, so in addition to skipping the encounter, they also in theory would have destroyed the thing they were there to get.
Yeah,
that would be difficult as a GM. Be like, okay, yeah, it's good thinking on the orc escaping. That's thinking on your feet.
Yeah, I think this is when I ultimately did the Primetime Adventures game. That was a like murder mystery, which mm-hmm. is something that, you know, everything tells you, do not do a mystery, especially as one of your first games. And I feel like this early experience was what both tempted me and gave me the confidence to just roll with the punches and make sure that the players were having a blast, even if it made no sense in the world that I was creating. Mm-hmm. It was just fun for them, and that was the point.
Yeah, well, I mean, that transferred itself very well to that Primetime Adventures game. It's interesting that you were given advice, like, not to do a mystery game for your first or one of your first games.
Yeah.
I've usually found that, like, mysteries are pretty, like, actually, I would have recommended them as a good starting point. Like, not to say that they're easy, but they provide, like, a really nice framework to, like, get people to investigate what's going on. So, as opposed to, like, something that's a little more, you know, something that's doesn't have a structured plot, it can be kind of hard to get the players out the door, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think the trick is that you have to be willing to make up clues mm-hmm. because players will not find the clues. Even if you think you made them really obvious, they're never too obvious. Like, I even saw that advice and was like, okay, I'll make really obvious clues. And this is for the Primetime Adventures game I ran. It's
yeah.
still, like, you and everyone else who was there was like, didn't see the clues that I had put there, which was fine because it just meant that it got to focus on other leads and other character developments, and I could adapt the clues to fit the situation, you know, so that if you had different leads, I could just move the clues to follow those leads so that it would feel really meaningful to you and the players to
nice.
Find,
see, I was
find
in that game,
clues.
So I can confirm we were really bad at finding clues.
Yeah.
I mean, the other trick that I learned for mystery games early was, like, if your players are like investigating something really hard, I will, if I can, I will try to create something that's there, even if I wasn't originally planning for there to be anything there. Just because it's like, man, they put so much time and energy into this. Like, they should find something.
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely.
It's like, roll well enough and you find a clue. that sort of thing.
Better than ice cream.
Yeah. All right, well, my first game, this is not technically my first game because I'd run a few before this when I was younger, but I think I can discount those because, like, I didn't really know how role-playing worked, mm-hmm. or, like, what a role-playing book was for. Like, I got a role-playing game book that my mom got me, and, like, I looked at it and I was like, I do not understand any of this. So I just was like, here, everyone have a character sheet, and I'm gonna write some numbers in there and, like, roll them for a bit. So I'm gonna discount that, because that was, I don't think, like, since if I didn't really understand what I was doing, I don't think I learned anything terribly useful. So my first, like, actual campaign was, like, third edition, not even 3.5. 3.5 wasn't out yet.
Oh, geez.
This was like, you know, third edition D&D, and it was like way back in the day, and I learned a few things, like, right off the bat. One was, don't put in a superpowered NPC because you had an idea for a character that you wanted to play in someone else's game. Just don't do that.
No, but they're so cool.
No, nobody thinks they're cool. Only you think they're cool. Yeah, so I did that, and I figured out pretty quickly that nobody else thought this character was cool, so I was like, okay, this character's gonna quietly retire, and we're never gonna see him again. So, you know, just don't do that. Like, I had been really excited for this character because I'd been reading, like, a fantasy series that had this mage in it that I really liked, and I wanted to play that character in a game, and, like, no one would run a game that was high enough level for me to play that character, so I was like, I know, I'll just play him in my game, where mm-hmm. he can be as high level as he wants. And it's like, nope. So, that was one. Second thing I learned was that a lot of role-playing systems will punish players for making choices that are cool as opposed to choices that are mechanically optimal, because you know, I had like, I think, four players in that game, and we had like our standard, like, you know, power gamed thief who was really good at backstabbing, power gamed fighter who was really good at hitting things with an axe, and like power gamed wizard. But then the cleric was actually kind of interesting. Like, the cleric's player had this whole backstory about how, like, he worshipped this sword goddess who was like looked down on in his like home country, and so he was kind of like seen as a bit sacrilegious, and he had like, you know, and like, because clerics aren't supposed to use swords because that was a thing in third edition D&D.
Yeah.
And so he like took like several feats to like let him use a sword as like a symbol of his goddess, and it like had this cool story, but it was like, those are really unoptimal feats, right? Like, he spent two feats to be able to use like a bastard sword, and it was just like, you could use, like, there are way better things you could do with those feats, right?
Mm-hmm.
He, like, constantly lagged behind the other players in what he was capable of because he was making choices that were cool for role-playing, and they were, you know, making more standard power gamey choices. And I eventually, like, sort of figured out I needed to do something, and he got, like, a super magic powerful sword from his goddess, and that balanced things out a little bit. So that was my second lesson. All right, my third lesson that I learned from this game was that that not all player feedback is good feedback.
What?
Like, yeah, I know, right? Because I was very into the idea of getting feedback from my players and being like, hey, how are you guys enjoying the game? What can I do to make the game better? Like, etc. You know, that sort of thing, right? But I had like one player who would routinely tell me that he didn't feel like he was getting enough loot compared to everybody else. And I was like, I kept looking, I was like, no, you're getting the same amount of loot as everybody else. Like, it's balanced, you're all getting the same amount of loot. And I eventually figured out that, like, he just wanted more loot. And, like, that was just not something that you should give into, right? Because, like, sometimes the player is just way too into their scenario of empowerment. And if you give them everything they want, it's going to reduce the enjoyment for everybody else at the table. So those were, like, my really big ones. But I've been talking for a while. Wes, I have a question for you.
Yeah, yeah.
So you said you didn't use dice.
Yeah.
Do you, like, remember what you did instead? Like, did you consult your character sheets at all?
We knew, yeah, we did consult them.
Okay.
And so we knew what their strengths, you know, we knew generally what their scores were, and we knew what weapons they used. So I think we just did basically max damage the whole time.
Yeah.
So it was deadly but pretty fun.
Yeah.
Which
it's a good time to have a great axe, I guess.
I mean, I don't like there's something to that with, I mean, we're going to talk about combat more specifically in a later podcast, right? But like, mm-hmm. you know, it can drag, and if you just have everybody yep. do max damage, then that combat goes over real fast.
It does.
So
it also avoids the really annoying, like, I strike the goblin with my massive axe and I roll a 1 and the goblin is like, meh.
Yeah.
You know, that makes you feel real silly when that happens.
Yeah. But no, that was, yeah, it was just kind of like, how much damage does your sword do? Oh, it's like a D8. Okay, you do 8 damage, right? Like, it was mm-hmm. just reference the sheet and then say the numbers and move on. And like I said earlier, I mean, I didn't really know how it worked, so I just kind of let them do damage until it seemed appropriate, and then we moved on.
That sounds like a pretty good way to do it.
it was that group was fun, and they were very flexible with that stuff. Yeah, I did enjoy that quite a lot.
Now, Sarah, you used fudge at the beginning. How much actual rules creation did you have to do? Like, does fudge come with its own skill systems and everything, or did you need to, like, decide these are the skills everyone has?
It sort of has a mechanic. It's sort of like using a stripped-down D20 system to build a role-playing game, so you can mm-hmm. create your own skills, but you use a standard way of rolling them.
Yeah.
So I definitely spent time, you know, coming up with the skills, what were the different races. Basically, I had so much fun making characters, so I spent a lot of time coming up with customizations for characters and mm-hmm. you know, what the different weapons were, and a lot of world building through those character customizations.
Actually, I have a follow-up on that and a question for both of you, because one thing that I do remember from early campaigns was, if this gets to Oren, you're talking about making a really cool NPC that you wanted to play. Sarah, I'm just curious if, like, you fell into that same trap, because I know I did, that, like, you ended up, like, creating really rich NPCs and backstories and stuff, because maybe in our hearts we just want to be players and let somebody else do all the planning. I mean, was that something, have you struggled with that, or, like, learned anything from that process?
As someone who rarely takes the GM seat, I've had the opportunity to play a lot of the characters that I imagined. And another thing that happened a lot when I was into my create epic level character with intricate backstory who's super angsty because of, you know, demons in her past, all of that basically happened during a period when me and my friends were making characters a lot and rarely playing with them. Because I think we realized this problem that we wanted to make cool characters, but when you're in a role-playing game, you can't be the cool loner. And we all wanted to be cool loners.
the whole party, cool loners.
And you just end up coming across like a dork because you're just going around rolling and failing all the time. So the solution was just make characters and share your ideas. Like, we even created elaborate, you know, with epic level characters, you can have strongholds. So we had the stronghold handbook, and, you know, this is all in D&D 3.0 and 3.5. So a lot of rules, but that was what we had fun doing. We rarely actually played with these characters. It was just, you know, using the role-playing game kind of framework to develop characters and stories.
Yeah, and like, well, like 3.5, I mean, I sunk many, many hours into 3.5 into, like, theory crafting various characters, because, like, in a way, 3.5 is like a really wonky physics engine.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it's like you can just do all kinds of like weird, like, you know, I mean, like, there's probably the most famous is the arrow that has like a portable, like, that has a portable hole and a bag of holding that combine when the arrow hits its target, right? Like, there's stuff like that, but, you know, like, you can make the character who can jump like 200 feet in the air if you want to, and then you can, like, turn that into, like, my favorite is, like, the character who can jump 200 feet in the air and then gets a magic item that lets him use his jump skill for diplomacy,
No.
yeah, the Jumplomancer, it's called.
What?
Oh my god, what?
Yeah, it's amazing. You just, like, run up to people and just go, like, whoop, and you just jump, like, way up in the air, and you come down, and they're like, that was amazing, we love you now, you're just so cool.
Okay, I'm kind of seeing that there are, like, three phases here. There's the early phase, when you're getting into role-playing, and you do all this wacky stuff because you don't know any better. And then, if you're doing, like, Dungeons & Dragons or GURPS, you start being, like, min-maxing everything, and you're like, you can't do anything cool anymore because you have to follow the rules. And then you get into this final phase if you realize the problem was the rules all along, and then you pick different role-playing systems that allow you to do the fun, crazy stuff that you were doing in the first stage.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's that's sort of the idea behind Torchbearer, regardless of, you know, if you actually like Torchbearer or not. It's certainly, like, sort of trying to capture what we all felt like we were doing, like, when we first started D&D. We are coming up to the end of this episode. So one more thing I want to ask you both is, since we've been talking about our first campaign, do you have any advice for players who are or are thinking of starting their first campaign, especially if they're thinking of doing it as adults? Because most of us, it sounds like we all got started as kids, like back when everyone's standards were lower.
Yeah. Sarah, why don't you take this first?
Sure. I guess I would recommend that if you're starting out, find a group of either very inexperienced people, because, mm-hmm. you know, people who are really, like, gung-ho and excited about the whole idea, basically other people who are in that, you know, middle school, high school mindset, or find really experienced players, or, you know, other people who have been GMs before, and, you know, hopefully they'll, like, understand where you're coming from and give you tips, and just, like, I think running that mystery game went a lot smoother because a lot of the players were experienced role players.
Right. And, like, sort of has to be the right experienced role players, right? Like, I know a lot of role players who I really love to play with, but, like, I would not pick them for a first game because, like, I know that their expectations would be too high.
I guess maybe go for people who have, like, if you don't know role players, especially, like, if someone has improv experience, like, that, mm-hmm. I think, you know, because you could run into people who are rules lawyers, but if you have improv experience, that's going to go over a lot easier.
Absolutely. All right, Wes, what do you got for us?
Yeah, no, that was some solid advice. I guess, like, for players, maybe you just kind of never know who's really going to take to the game. So I think any amount of, like, interest, no matter, like, how small, like, somebody might really get turned on and have a really fun time with it. I think, just know the game well, but you don't have to know it perfectly.
Right.
And, like, keep the focus on the characters, because they are the game. It's like you're like providing their game for them. Right, like, it's not about you and your cool story. Like, that should be your focus. And so that way, if they tell you they have fun, you consider that a success. Because running campaigns, like, I'm super critical of myself. I'm sure other GMs are too. But as long as players have fun, it's a success. So keep that in mind. And then, yeah, do whatever you can to minimize any kind of debates or arguments. Those will happen, but be flexible and be consistent, right? Don't
be decisive.
Don't randomly do things either. Like, make sure that your logic holds throughout the thing, or else people are gonna just push you even farther and argue, and then nobody has fun.
No, it's really important to spend, like, 2 hours arguing over whether or not that one prestige class in that counts as both a level of cleric and wizard gives you double the caster level your true necromancer build.
Yes.
Like, that's really important. It really matters. You have to argue about it. It's very important.
Maybe one more thing, Oren. I'd like you to jump in here real quick. I still get this, but I'm better at dealing with it. But when players think of, like, cool stuff or, like, try to do stuff that might destroy, like, my villains or my plans, I have a like reaction to try to, like, make that not happen that usually I can push back on. But I would advise, like, again, to, like, let people just let them have their fun. Have you dealt with that at all?
Well, that's kind of a sword without a handle, as the Game of Thrones characters would say. Because on the one hand, like, yes, if you just start throwing down fiat walls around what players can and can't do because the thing they want to do is, like, inconvenient for your story, mm-hmm. like, that is definitely going to negatively impact the experience. But so will accidentally losing your main villain in the first session, and then, like, you don't have a main villain anymore, and, like, if you aren't really good at recovering from that, the campaign will suffer, because it's like, well, I had all these things lined up, and they needed that villain, and that villain is gone now, so...
Right.
yeah, it's, like, super context-specific. In general, my best advice there is if your players try to do something like that, give them something that, like, other than the destruction of that villain you needed. Like, give them some other reward for their clever thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, let them do something really cool and then, like, be like, yeah, man, you dealt them, like, you stabbed them in the gut. They are gonna need, like, 2 weeks of surgery for that. But, like, they just barely managed to scramble away, right? That's nice, or something yeah. like that. I mean, ideally, you don't put yourself in a position where that sort of thing can happen, but nobody's perfect, right? All right. Well, thank you both for joining us for this discussion on our first campaigns. And we all actually got started quite young. I was like wondering if anyone on here was like, yeah, my first game was when I was 25. but anyway, those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interests, you can contact us at podcast@mythcreants.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
Treat your friends to an evening of dark ritual murder. In a fictional game scenario, of course. The Voyage is a standalone RPG full of spooks and frights. For sale on mythcreants.com. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.